Ed, tell me a little bit more about the Center for Science and the Imagination. What is your purpose?
The center has a really unusual mission. Our mission is to get people thinking more creatively and ambitiously about the future, which, if you think about it, is a pretty weird thing for a university research center to do. And it's been fantastic. It's the kind of job where I wake up every morning and think to myself, are they still going to let me do this? And every day, you know, the reality police have not burst through the door yet and dragged me back into some less interesting universe. So what we mean by getting people to think more creatively and ambitiously about the future is that we want to use stories, we want to use narratives and a whole bunch of other tools to change the relationship that we have with the future. So one of the things I like to talk about is the fact that the future is not something that a bunch of people in white lab coats are building somewhere in some corporate lab or government facility. It's not something that's going to get unveiled in a big, shiny product announcement. And it's not something that's inevitable. It's not something that we're just going to passively wait around to arrive, which is, when you think about it, what most of us do most of the time. We just say, well, it's too complicated. It's too messy. I don't understand it. I'm just going to focus on the here and now and wait and see what happens.
So why? Is there something wrong with the current model of how we're doing it?
Well, I think that our culture has shifted more and more to think about the present. And we've lost sight of history as well, right? So the future and the past have a really deep relationship. And the past is one of the only useful tools we have to actually figure out what might happen in the future. That's something that a scientist or a historian would tell you. So what we do now is we think mostly about the day-to-day. And if you think about politics, if you think about the way that we plan our lives, you think about the housing crisis, we're increasingly encouraged to think only about the near-term future. And it's hard to really think even 10 or 20 years ahead, much less think about what our children's lives will be like or our grandchildren's lives. So it's very difficult to create that frame of mind to think about the long term. And that's kind of different. It used to be different. If you think about the kind of mindset that built the pyramids or that built the great enduring structures of the world, those were projects that lasted beyond a single human lifetime. The people who got up the gumption to start them knew full well that they were never going to finish them in their own lives. Maybe they were insanely optimistic and they thought, yeah, we can do this in 5 years or 10 years. But I think that they knew. And they did it anyway. They did it because they had a different relationship with time.
You know, you just use the word optimism, and throughout all of your descriptions, the word optimism comes up, and the phrase thoughtful optimism. Is that utopian? Is that utopian? Is that different from an optimism?
It's different. So we don't set ourselves up as utopian dreamers. And the difference for me is that thoughtful optimism is really more like pragmatism. So we embrace dystopian visions of the future. I think 1984 was a wonderful novel, and it's a really important book. And the stuff that we do at the center is not against dystopian science fiction, though we do like to talk a lot about how dystopian, when we do think about the future now, it's often in dystopian terms. If you look at almost any Hollywood movie of the recent era that presents a future, it's about some world that's either completely fallen apart or, even worse, has mostly fallen apart, and the few people who are staggering on, you know, live in some post-apocalyptic hellscape, right? And so we want to try and we talk about thoughtful optimism as a way to balance out the dystopian and the utopian, to find a middle way, and actually to use both of those extremes to map out a kind of spectrum of possibility. So instead of thinking about the future as this inevitable single pathway, instead of thinking about 1984 as this horribly correct prognostication, right, which is what some people do to say, oh my gosh, you know, we've been on this path for decades now and we're never going to escape. Instead of doing that, what if we say, well, let's use the nightmares and the dreams together to come up with a roadmap to the world that we really want to live in.
You know, so, I mean, it's like a flood, though, dystopian, when you think about science fiction, like you said, for any movie, for books. It wasn't always that way, though, right? I mean, there was a long time, I mean, during the golden age of science fiction, where things were much more utopian. Why is there so much dystopia now?
I think there are a lot of reasons. It's a complicated answer. I think part of it has to do with the era in the 1930s and the 1940s when the golden age of science fiction emerged. And by the way, this is one of the first things I did when we started at the center. Even before we officially launched, we organized this exhibit of golden age science fiction. Arizona State University has this wonderful collection of old science fiction magazines and books. And to my mind, other people might have other reasons for this, but I think one of the major reasons that the golden age came to an end was the atomic bomb and World War II and the technophilia of the Nazis and the way that a lot of movements, especially during and after World War II, took that logic of technological supremacy and united it to something really scary and evil. So the Nazis probably identified with the golden age, that vision of these rational engineers conquering the universe, except they connected it to some other things that most of us find abhorrent. And so that was a hard blow. And the unleashing the energy of the atom was another moment where if you'd been reading science fiction in the 1930s, you would have said, yes, this is it. This is a big breakthrough. We're going to get unlimited energy. We're going to transform the world. We're going to start exploring space. We're going to create the Orion spacecraft and, you know, use nuclear fission as a way to propel ships much faster than we've been able to in the past. And instead, the nuclear bomb led to the Cold War. It led to 50 years of, you know, teaching kids to hide under desks. Hmm. And so it totally transformed our relationship with technology and the future. And I think that had a really profound impact on the kinds of visions we produced afterwards. Now, there were dystopian visions before that, and there were optimistic visions after that. This is not a global rule. But I think that really changed. And I think as we became more jaded about technology, and I think that really started during World War II and its aftermath, are the kinds of stories we began to tell, the kinds of stories that seemed real and plausible to us became more dystopian. They became more jaded.
Okay,
like
so
cyberpunk emerged.
So that has some steam, okay? The dystopian vision, the pessimistic future has some steam. The narrative has some steam in our culture. You're trying to reverse the flow. How do you change the narrative of a culture, how they see the future? That's a big task.
It's a big job. Yeah. It's a really fun job. So the way you start is you tell better stories, right? You can't have better futures without better dreams. And so that's one of our mantras at the center. And our job isn't to tell people what to think or to create some kind of universal logic for the future. Our job is to come up with specific, tangible ideas, specific concepts that might push us towards some new direction. And so that's what we try and do. And we're working with a lot of science fiction writers and other creative thinkers who have had a huge influence on the future as we've constructed it now. Neil Stevenson, Bruce Sterling.
Well, tell us about that. That's the Hieroglyph Project. It's amazing. We've been reading about it in our office for days. Tell us about Neil Stevenson's project you guys are doing.
So this project, in a lot of ways, is the reason that the center exists. So I'll tell you the origin story of the project.
Sure.
So ASU's president, Michael Crow, who's a pretty unusual guy for a university president in that he would create something as weird as the center, is a big science fiction guy. And he was at an event with Neil Stevenson, the author. And Neil Stevenson was up on stage talking about this idea he has called innovation starvation. He had recently written an essay about this, and his argument is that we seem to have lost our ambition to do big stuff. We went from the Apollo missions and these giant national infrastructure projects to 140 characters and paying other countries to fly stuff up into space for us and watching all of those grand national infrastructure projects crumble around us. And so he was saying, Where has our ambition gone? And at the same time, why have we become so dystopian in our thinking about the future? And Crow's response to this was, well, maybe this is all your fault. Maybe it's the science fiction writers who've been letting us down. Neil, you've written a lot of, you know, fairly dystopian cyberpunk visions of the future, books like Snow Crash. And that struck a spark, and they started talking. And that conversation landed on my desk. I had a fellowship at ASU. Another sign of the unusual nature of this institution is I had a job called University Innovation Fellow. So it fell to me to figure out, well, this conversation happened and there was some interest in doing something, but we don't really know what that would be. And so I had one of those afternoons where it was really easy to write a short sketch of a center for science and the imagination that would bring together science fiction writers, scientists, engineers, other scholars and researchers to come up with thoughtfully optimistic visions of the future, like we've been talking
about. And I want to interrupt you here because I think that what's important to separate here is that in academia, what you normally get is you get some symposium post-book, post-paper, post-invention, and everybody gets together and talks about it from different fields. What you're talking about is before the idea, right? The idea that these different groups, the engineer, the poet, they come up with the ideas together, right?
Absolutely. So Project Hieroglyph, excuse me. Absolutely. So Project Hieroglyph is, like a lot of things we do at the center, it's about thinking through doing. We actually try these experiments. And so the other outcome of that conversation between Neal Stephenson and Michael Crow was that Neal Stephenson started to dream up this idea of a project that would bring together science fiction writers with scientists and engineers to write stories set in the near future to basically answer Michael Crow's challenge, to come up with visions of the future that were optimistic, that would encourage young people to enter STEM fields, that would encourage young scientists and engineers to maybe read one of these stories and actually bring that vision to life.
Has that happened yet? Has that come to fruition? Are people starting on that? Has there been a short story that's inspired a space program or inspired an invention?
One of the coolest things about this project is that the science fiction, because it's set in the near future, is constantly at risk of being eclipsed by the real world and actual technological progress. So what we did, Neal Stephenson initially began recruiting some people, and then the center at ASU became the anchor point for this collaboration. And we continued to recruit writers, and we paired them up with scientists and engineers. And yeah, several of these stories have started to drive real scientific questions. So one of the best examples is Neal Stephenson's own story for the project. So he had been reading a couple of papers about building tall towers as a way to save rocket fuel when you launch stuff into space. Because if you launch a rocket from 10 miles high, you save a huge amount of the fuel that you would need to get that first part of the journey done. And so he found this structural engineer at ASU, a guy named Keith Jelmstadt, and he asked Keith, well, how tall could we build something? And this was one of the first test cases, actually, for the whole idea of Hieroglyph. You know, would an engineer or a scientist really want to talk to one of these science fiction writers and have this sort of crazy conversation? And to our great delight, Keith loved it because he said, first of all, he's been a structural engineer for 20 plus years. He said, nobody's ever asked me that question. That's not how structural engineers approach this problem. They look at what's been done before and say, well, how could we improve it a little bit? They come at the whole idea of building things from a completely different angle, a different framework. And so he loves this project because it fires up his students and it fires up his colleagues. And he's really passionate about the engineering curriculum. So just a few weeks ago, he sent me one of his undergraduate students, a student in ASU's Barrett Honors College, who wants to build a 10-meter tall model of this tower. Because he came to me and said, you know, I've been working with Dr. Jelmstadt, and I think I have some improvements to the design that he's come up with, and, you know, I want to build this thing. And to me, that's really exciting because it's one of those steps that we really hoped would happen where, you know, this is a young future engineer who's excited about this project and who wants to push it forward. Now, I would love to see the tall tower built, but to my mind, that's actually not the primary objective of Project Hieroglyph. It's about getting people to ask these questions. And with the tall tower itself, we quickly realized that Keith Jelmstadt, for all of his deep knowledge about steel and construction techniques and stressors on building wasn't going to be able to answer all the questions that you would need to answer to construct this giant 20-kilometer tall tower. You need to know about seismology and what parts of the earth would be stable enough to build a giant structure like that. You need to know about the jet stream. You need to know about conductivity and whether you could generate power from this thing by the voltage through the voltage differential between the upper atmosphere and the ground.
You would need to know from other people, anthropologists and others, what a symbol like that would mean, right? You would also,
absolutely.
There are other fields, right? I was thinking you have to be careful of what it means as well. You're going back to what you said with the Nazis and technology. How do you build in with this, building on that, when you do these things? History is long, right? How do you make sure we don't make the same mistake? We almost killed ourselves. We almost destroyed the world through our last big technological jump. How do we not make that mistake again?
Well, that's one of the profound questions of the longue durée, the big view of history. And arguably, we're beginning to open up new Pandora's boxes that might be even more dangerous than the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about the genetic manipulation of diseases. You think about the climate change and the way in which we're changing the fundamental systems of the planet without really understanding what we're doing. There are lots of things that we could do. And this is something that another writer who's involved with Project Hieroglyph, David Brin, talks about. He talks about these filter points. When we look at, if you're familiar with the Drake equation, it's this equation that tries to guess as to how many other intelligent species might exist in the universe.
Right.
And the big question with the Drake equation is, why we haven't heard from anybody, you know, that's the first question. And the second question is, what values do we assign to these different factors? And what are the big filter points? You know, what are the, is the big problem that there's only a 2% chance that any species is going to make it through the atomic age without blowing itself to smithereens, right? Or maybe it's more like a 70% chance that everybody's going to make it through, or a species will survive that new kind of power and learn to control it without losing control of it. So we don't know where the filter points are. That's the big problem. And we don't know whether we've made it through the most difficult ones or whether they're still to come. And that's why we need better stories to try and speculate and push the edge and think through not just the stuff we know about, but the things we're just beginning to see as technologies that don't have a use yet, as ideas that don't have an anchor point. Some of the most interesting technological discoveries have come from combining things that already existed in novel ways that suddenly became transformative.
You know, it's so interesting to me. I think about how specialized we are, about a geneticist who's like does only one thing in their whole life that's very specific. It seems like there's a need for a narrative for them as well. There's nothing wrong. These aren't people that have even a dystopian view. They just want to have something bigger than they are to believe in. And maybe they're an atheist, but they want something bigger. It seems that fiction and the arts offers that as well.
I think that fiction and the arts are vitally important for creating a conversation that everybody can share. Because I think that geneticists, most scientists that I've interacted with, are deeply passionate about their work. They do have a narrative. They know what they're doing and why they're doing it, and they have some grander vision. They can't always articulate that in a way that other people can understand outside of their discipline, because the structure of higher education and technical research today funnels people so intensely down into something incredibly specific. And so a good story, a good science fiction story, can invite everybody in to a collective vision of the future, because a science fiction story doesn't need to detail every nut and bolt of a new discovery. It just needs to give you a thumbnail sketch. And then you, the reader, or the listener, the audience, use your imagination to fill out that world and to solve a lot of the problems in your own head. And so this is something that Neal Stephenson likes to say, is that a good science fiction story can save you hundreds of hours of PowerPoints and meetings, because you know, it can put hundreds of people from different disciplines working on a problem together on the same page as to the broader ambition. And this is part of that. The reason this thing is called Project Hieroglyph is this idea that we could come up with these new hieroglyphic icons, these big ideas that could drive lots of different people to work on a problem collectively. So, you know, Heinlein's rocket ship or Isaac Asimov's robots, those were really sticky ideas that are still with us today, that still shape our thinking about what robots might be or what space travel might look like. They were so successful as ideas that they have become these icons that, you know, in a way are timeless themselves.
I think the Mars trilogy has done that now, too. I mean, everyone you talk to has read those, which is nice because it has an optimistic worldview. And it seems like Mars itself, just the place, has this view for us. How do you – I'm just talking specifically. Is there any talk in the work that you're doing about the possibility of colonization that has come up in the past?
There are a few conversations that I've had. The one that immediately springs to mind is Cory Doctorow's story for the Hieroglyph Anthology. And that's one of the stories I was thinking of when I said that the science fiction threatens to be eclipsed by reality. So Cory's story imagines a bunch of hackers and makers who meet each other through Burning Man, the festival in the Mojave Desert, and they create this wind-powered and sun-powered robot that'll fuse the dust of the playa into ceramic tiles that then you can use to build stuff. And so that's the sort of the first phase. It's this story about the ingenuity of makers and hackers. And then they decide to do a Kickstarter project to send one of these robots to the moon with the idea that it will send this 3D printer to the moon, basically, and it'll kick around the moon powered by the sun for years or decades, creating the raw materials for a future moon base, maybe even assembling structures that could be used by later colonists or other robots. And so what's fun about that idea first is the way, being a Cory Doctorow story, this doesn't involve, you know, clean-cut engineers in some government lab. It's a bunch of tattooed sort of miscreants, brilliant miscreants wandering around the desert who create this thing. It's a great story. And then that we have this vision of a future that is ad hoc, is collectively constructed. And what's exciting is that NASA and the European Space Agency are actually funding research on this. And I think some of the research gave Cory the idea for the story. And I hope that Cory's story will continue to inspire people to work on this project. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if by the time the book comes out this September, we're going to have more news about how you would actually do this in real life, maybe some kind of a prototype. There are already a couple of different research groups who are thinking about lunar regolith and how you would take that moon dust and form it into some kind of durable material. So it's really exciting stuff.
Yeah, if you do a future reprint of that book in 20 years, you'll have to put a little asterisk and say, by the way, this isn't science fiction anymore. It actually happened. That would be great.
Yeah, this is a serious problem we have. So the book is in production right now. You know,
Better hurry up.
I know. Well, we have to for a lot of several of the writers have had to make little tweaks to their stories. Or
that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Yeah. You must be thrilled.
I'm delighted. I mean, that's part of. So you know, what's really exciting about this project is that we asked everybody to step outside of their comfort zones. The writers, the scientists, and the engineers, and to talk about stuff when it's only half formed in their minds, to actually share ideas at that brainstorming and that initial phase and not just tell each other about the polished, you know, final products that are sort of safe and have been vetted and are ready to share with the world. And different people responded to that challenge in different ways, but overall we've been tremendously excited by the fact that people were willing to do it and take these risks. So the writers were not just commissioned to go off and write a story and then send it to us, or even as sometimes happens in the science fiction world, to say, well, what have you got? You know, we need a story that talks about topic X. And, you know, this was totally different. And we asked everybody to participate in this online community that we've built, which is, to my mind, actually the most exciting part of the project. And that's the book is really just the beginning. It's not really the end of this process, because we want to do new projects with Hieroglyph. Now that we have this community of hundreds of people who include those we've directly recruited from ASU and from other universities, the writers we brought on board, but also just people who came out of the woodwork, researchers in solar energy that I'd never heard of, who volunteered their own time from other countries to get involved, people who are professional audio engineers, people who work in many different fields who are science fiction fans or just fans of the future in broad terms and changing the way we think about it. There are a lot of people who heard the signal of this project and have wanted to get involved. And if you've been reading the site, you can see these amazing conversations. You know, one of my favorites is called Banning Agriculture, which quickly turned to a conversation of space potatoes. And it involved Carl Schroeder and Bruce Sterling, two wonderful science fiction writers, but also undergrads at ASU and members of the general public, all sharing ideas in a very egalitarian way.
You know, I love your mission statement. I was actually reading it with a coworker this morning out loud, like in a real grandiose way. It's pretty over the top. It's very big. And there's this great phrase in it. For example, you say that you stand for audacious moonshot ideas. Is that how we change the world? Is it audacity that changes it?
A lot of times, I think it's the only way to change the world. So, you know, the world is always changing, right? We're always moving in some direction. But the only way to consciously change the world is to be bold, is to have a big idea, and to tell a good story about it. If you look at the great inventions of history, it's not the person who comes up with a brilliant idea who really moves that thing forward. It's the person who comes up with the right story to tell about it and gives people a way to understand this new idea, not just in the abstract, but in their own lives, to give people a sense of agency that they're participating in this future. And that's really what we mean by audacious moonshot ideas. It's, if you think about the Apollo missions, it wasn't just about a series of technical challenges. It wasn't just about astronauts and mission controllers. It was about a whole country and really the whole world getting behind this thing and buying into a kind of modern-day myth of what the human species could do.